This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. All right, this one is for the history majors among you. The actual quote is, "I always thought what was good for our country was good for General Motors and vice versa. The news today has GM doing what's best for it." From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 26th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It is rare indeed that a corporate CEO, in announcing a big reorganization, lays out almost to a T the two main storylines of her announcement. But on a conference call this morning, General Motors' Mary Barra obliged.
"We will align our product portfolio and manufacturing capacity with shifting customer preferences, and we will transform our global workforce to ensure we have the right skill sets to win today and in the future."
GM, as you probably heard by now, is going to shut down 5 plants in North America, phase out a couple more sedan models, and lay off almost 15,000 people, blue-collared and salaried, over the next year or so. So, as Ms. Barra laid out, two stories from us now about GM's products and its workforce. Marketplace's Justin Ho has the jobs angle.
"Every automaker is under pressure as the industry moves toward electric and self-driving cars," says Carl Brower at Kelley Blue Book.
"General Motors sees the changes that are coming, and they're wanting to be ahead of this."
GM says it'll double its investment in electric and automated cars over the next 2 years. Last month, its CEO said she wants people to think of GM as a tech company by the time she retires. Brower says that while certain workers could make that transition,
"That's going to be a much harder transition for someone who, if they've spent their career building traditional automobiles, they're not going to easily get to that new skill set."
Instead of layoffs, companies like GM could train their existing workers, which actually used to happen a lot in manufacturing. But times have changed, says Georgetown economist Harry Holzer.
"The manufacturing sector has been shrinking. Unions used to run a lot of those training programs. They're not around much to do that anymore."
GM says the layoffs will hit everyone from plant workers to engineers and executives. Still, Holzer says it's the people higher along the chain of command that are most likely to survive the cuts.
"American companies have always been willing to invest a lot more in their professional and managerial employees because they think they're going to stick around longer. They think they're good tools for investment."
In a statement, the United Auto Workers Union says it'll challenge the decision to stop production at plants in Ohio, Michigan, and Maryland. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
That's the people part. The products part is going to have GM saying goodbye to a couple of sedan models, the Cruze, the Impala, and the electric Volt among them. The company is betting it's going to pay off as car sales continue to slow. So Marketplace's Jed Kim looked into how that might play out in the long run.
There are some obvious and not so obvious reasons behind GM's decision. Obvious? Demand is low. Kristen Gijek is with the Center for Automotive Research. She says U.S. car plants have the ability to produce a certain number of vehicles. Right now, there are
3.2 million units of underutilized capacity, and a million of it is General Motors. Almost all of it sedans.
Car sales are declining in the U.S. and in China, which had been a steady market for GM. Plus, new car buyers are looking at crossovers, SUVs, and trucks. Gijek says tariffs and the looming threat of more have also factored into the decision.
"Everything raises the cost of building a vehicle in the United States."
That means charging more, which means selling less. What's less obvious is that this kind of drastic restructuring typically happens when companies have hit the skids. But GM just posted a pretty good quarterly profit. So what gives? Jeff Schuster is with LMC Automotive.
They're looking for a cost structure that allows them to take some of their earnings and investment and put it towards the longer term, which is autonomous vehicles.
It's a long game approach that'll keep them more nimble. David Whiston is an auto equity analyst at Morningstar, and he says the company's also weighing the likelihood of a recession.
GM's taking some moves now at the top of the cycle to prepare themselves for the downturn, rather than waiting for the downturn to happen and then announce restructuring, which I think is a smart move.
GM's competitors will be taking note of this restructuring. Many of their factories are also running below capacity. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Speaking of GM's competitors, that's not the only car maker that's making fewer kinds of cars, right? Ford has said it's going to stop selling its Fiesta and its Focus in this country. And we've got more on what other models, other companies might be planning to discontinue. It's online at marketplace.org. All right, so the GM story today is one of economic realities, right? And adjusting to them. Here is another one, but bigger, planet size, you could say. A reality that could define all the other economic realities. Late this past Friday, arguably the best time to let loose bad news, the White House released its fourth national climate assessment. And it was, as you've surely heard or read by now, dire. Among the predictions was that if we don't take global warming seriously by the end of this century, the American economy is going to be 10% smaller than it otherwise would have been. So we asked Marketplace's Bree Benishore to ask some experts what that's going to be like.
If you want to know what an economy burdened by climate change looks like 80 years from now, just look around you.
The costs and damages are not just something in the distant future. They're already happening.
Brenda Equerzel is director of climate science at the Union of Concerned Scientists and is a co-author of the National Climate Assessment. She gives the example of Western Digital. It's a U.S. company. It produces 60% of its hard drives in Thailand, where there was extreme flooding in 2011.
And they sustained nearly $200 million in losses and a shipment reduction of over 50% fewer hard drives.
Those shortages doubled the price of hard drives on the global market for a while, affecting U.S. companies like Apple, HP, and Dell. That is just one company, one supply chain. Climate change means more and more extreme natural disasters, and we will all be footing the bill, says Francis Moore at the University of California, Davis.
What you're going to see is increasing government spending on and private spending on adapting and just responding to these extreme events.
Every year, the U.S. would be laying out hundreds of billions of dollars, repairing roads, rebuilding infrastructure, adjusting supply chains.
Those funds are being diverted away from kind of other more productive investments that would be leading to a larger economy.
The National Climate Assessment says these costs could be cut in half if the world abided by the emissions levels in the Paris Climate Agreement, from which the U.S. has withdrawn. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, any guesses on GM shares? Come on. It's a gimme, really. You cut 15,000 jobs, you add 5% to your share price. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One hates to point an accusing finger, but consider it pointed at you. And whichever digit you're using to click that buy button on this Cyber Monday, traditionally the busiest online shopping day of the year. If years past are prologue, more people than ever are going to take advantage this holiday season of the deep discounts and, let's face it, convenience of buying gifts online. But even though they are ordered virtually, all those real-life packages got to get where they're going somehow. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more now on what your online shopping habits could mean for your life on the road.
It is go time for Noe Hernandez and his fellow delivery drivers at a DHL shipping center near downtown Los Angeles, where they usually make about 6,500 deliveries a day. That number is expected to jump 40% between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
I love being out in the streets, and I love interacting with people, so it's a hell out of sitting behind a desk, you know what I mean?
He'll need that enthusiasm as he gears up for the crazy holiday season.
You know what? It's hectic. I like that rush, that chaos. I love it.
Americans are expected to spend $120 billion online this holiday, up 15% from last year. That sends folks like Hernandez into overdrive, and every last second counts. So this bumper-to-bumper traffic really isn't helping.
I'm trying my best to keep my composure. I don't want to lose it.
A traffic jam in L.A. is certainly nothing out of the ordinary, but our growing reliance on deliveries from an army of people like Hernandez around the holidays and beyond is having ripple effects on our roadways that we still don't totally understand.
Clearly, urban traffic congestion is a challenge, but online shopping is in many ways a net gain.
Economist Joe Courtwright is director of the urban planning think tank City Observatory, and he sees e-commerce as a good thing.
When you buy stuff online, that means you take fewer trips to the store. So that has the effect of offsetting trips that we would make typically by automobile.
That's true and not true.
Professor Genevieve Giuliano is the director of the MetTrans Transportation Center at the University of Southern California. She says in theory, e-commerce could save some trips, but there's one big problem.
I'm starting to call free two-day shipping the evil incentive.
Because, she says, it encourages consumers to be inefficient. We might order vitamins 1 hour, coffee filters the next, make a million little purchases that we expect right away. Giuliano says that leads to more trucks making more trips to your house for things you would have probably picked up all at once at the store. And what might you do with the time you saved?
You may decide that you have so much extra time, you will go visit your cousin. So what we have is more trucks and more people driving around.
And it's not just space on the road that trucks are competing for. It's space at the curb.
There's a FedEx truck parked there. There's a UPS truck down there. If we go around the corner, you'll see there's FedEx trucks, FedEx and UPS all around the corners, regular postal trucks.
Transportation planner Sam Morrissey is pointing to a busy block in downtown L.A. that sees the highest number of commercial vehicle citations in the entire city. Delivery trucks make an average of 90 stops a day here, illegally. There's no parking or loading zone, so they simply block traffic, racking up about 1,200 citations a year.
Blocks the progression for the buses on this street. Down there, this is the slowest part because of all the double parking.
In super dense cities like New York, the problem is even worse. Delivery companies get so many tickets, more than 2 million a year, they negotiate a bulk rate discount. Morrissey says that's just the cost of doing business for DHL and other delivery companies as drivers like Noe Hernandez battle the clock to make their next delivery on time.
DHL, delivery?
Come on in, open the door.
Will do.
He makes his delivery right under the wire.
So every day I get that was fast. So just seeing the people's faces and how happy they get, it's gratifying.
Even if they do end up waiting a little longer on the road because of it. In Los Angeles, I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
The subtext, and really it's not so sub, to be honest, right, of the GM announcement today is that 10 years ago, just as the financial crisis was tightening its hold, taxpayers bailed out GM, and Chrysler too, to be fair, on the theory that letting them go under would mean millions of auto industry-related jobs going away. We told you some of those stories earlier this month, how the crisis changed the American car business. Today, a more personal slice of that theme. Jenna Collins lives in Chatham County, North Carolina. She was a 53-year-old stay-at-home mom in 2008. And today, 10 years later, her life's a whole lot different.
My husband owned and operated a Chevrolet dealership. And it wasn't that his business became bad. It was quite profitable. It was that suddenly the bank pulled the financing for all those cars you see out on the lot. If there's no credit, then you can't do business. And nationwide, over 2,000 dealerships at that time went under. We had a fairly affluent lifestyle. I was able to stay home and raise my son. And I would not worry about going shopping. I didn't really keep to a close budget, but my husband is 10 years older than me, and he was close to retirement age, 63, 64. So it was quite interesting thinking about taking over a role of being the breadwinner. I'd been out of the workforce for 15 years, and I didn't even have a resume. It was very humbling to go to interviews, and the people that are interviewing you are young enough to be your son or daughter. I couldn't sleep. It was frightening to not know whether I was going to be able to help support my family. Fortunately, I was able to find an entry-level job in ad sales, but I was
not really making very much money. So I did start to think about, what else could I do? Surely I can get a second job. I decided I would get certified to teach Pilates before and after work and at lunchtime. I'm not like complaining about my life. It's changed, but it's just different. It's not worse. I never had this pace before, and I sleep good at night because I work so much that I'm exhausted. Looking back to before the crisis, I was bored compared to now, but shopping and travel, and I didn't go to work during the day, so I wasn't tired all the time. Yeah, that was pretty nice too.
We've got a picture of Jenna and more about her story on our Instagram. We're at MarketplaceAPM. And while you're there, we'd love it if you'd share your story about how the financial crisis changed you. The hashtag we're using is How We Changed. Coming up.
I've talked to people who haven't taken a single vacation in 2 years, but people love it.
Huh. First, though, let's do the numbers. Well, we were up today, helped by a tech rebound. Dow Industrials climbed 354 points, 1.4%, 24,640. The NASDAQ up 142 points, 2%, 7,081. The S&P 500 moved ahead 40 points, about 1.5%, 26,073. So about those tech stocks, Facebook rose 3.5% today. Apple found 1.3%. Amazon delivered 5.2%. Good day in the market for retail stocks, too. Target gained 2.8%. Nike ran ahead 1.7% today. GM, I told you about. Ford gained 2.9%. Fiat Chrysler jumped 4.9% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 3.05%. You're listening to Marketplace. Anne in Stamford, Connecticut, wrote to say that Marketplace and Make Me Smart help her contextualize so much of what is happening in the world right now in a way that is approachable and entertaining. Anne, thanks for being a friend to Marketplace and for supporting our work. To join her as a Marketplace investor, donate online at marketplace.org. And thanks to everybody who contributes to keep public service journalism strong.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. British Prime Minister Theresa May is one step closer on this Monday to getting her country out of the European Union. At a meeting in Brussels yesterday, the soon-to-be 27 remaining members of the EU approved May's Brexit plan. But she is, however, still at least one very long step away from a done deal. Parliament's got to buy off on the agreement. May has set that vote for December 11th, by the way. And the prospect of that vote has more and more people and businesses over there saying they just want to call the whole thing off. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
We demand a people's vote!
pro-EU protesters outside Parliament last week. They say Theresa May's deal is vastly inferior to EU membership. They claim it would turn Britain into a colony bound by EU rules but without a say in deciding those rules and unable unilaterally to walk away from them. Among the protesters here, Polly Earnest and Steve Bray say there's got to be a second referendum.
I just think we need a people's vote because leaving the EU on that stupid deal that Theresa May's put together is just rubbish. We just lose so much and we look stupid.
Nobody's getting what they voted for. I think it is time to come back to the people because this government cannot sort this mess out. It's down to us, the people.
Many businesses also support a second referendum. A recent poll suggested that 57% of UK companies, from mom-and-pop stores up to the biggest multinationals, support the call for another vote. And that includes this small British clothing company, purveyor of what it calls very patriotic underpants.
We make boxer shorts. We're fighting for British design, British production, British product.
Deborah Price and her husband Darren own British Boxers, the company proudly named after Deborah's great-great-great-grandfather, the bare-knuckle fighter, Jem Mace.
He was the first world heavyweight boxing champion in 1870. He beat a guy called Tom Allen in America.
Although her brand taps into British heritage, self-reliance and fighting spirit, it relies for its full range of underpants and pyjamas on an intricate European supply chain.
We have piping coming from one of the best piping factories in the world. That's in France. We have fabric from Holland, from Portugal, from Italy. And that's just to get the goods made. Then we're selling them.
Back into Europe, Deborah and Darren are terrified of the tariffs and trade restrictions they may face after Brexit. They want a second referendum.
Given the range of information that we have now, given the more full knowledge of what the impacts of leave will be on the British economy, then I think we want a second referendum, and I think that second referendum will result in a Remain vote.
If Parliament rejects Theresa May's plan next month, Remainers like Darren and Deborah want the EU to delay Britain's departure date so the UK can stage another people's vote. Brexiteers are not happy, however. They were also protesting outside Parliament last week. John Longworth of Leave Means Leave says if Britain now begged to remain in the EU, it would soon be sucked into a United States of Europe.
We would face having to agree to join the Eurozone, the European Army, and all the other things that the European superstate are heading towards at the moment.
Theresa May has brought Leavers and Remainers together, but only in opposition to her plan. On the issue of a second referendum, though, the two sides are wide apart. Matthew Jenkins and Patricia Wilmot, demonstrating in favour of Brexit outside Parliament last week, said calls for another referendum are an attempt to overturn the biggest vote in British history.
The people have already spoken. Quite decisively, it was the biggest turnout we've had for anything.
They came out in their hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people thinking, this is my chance to make a difference. And then to find they're going to be ignored, it means we do not live in a democracy.
Britain's Brexit agony drags on with weeks and perhaps months of political and possibly economic unrest ahead. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Believe me when I tell you that we did not intend for cars to be the theme of the program today, but the news is what the news is. GM, we did, right? Layoffs, restructuring, getting ready for electric and self-driving cars. But over at a certain electric first car company, the resumes are piling up faster than the company can handle them. Tesla was one of the most popular companies with younger workers last year. Kelsey G wrote about it. She covers the workplace for Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tesla, it turns out, is an amazingly popular workplace with young, technically minded people. Go figure that out.
Yeah, it was a bit surprising to me as well because the impression that I've gotten is that it's a really frantic place to work. I've talked to people who haven't taken a single vacation in 2 years, but people love it.
Not to buy farther into the Elon Musk cult of personality, but how much of that is because of what he represents, which is, at some level, changing the planet?
That's a really great point. For all of the drama that has followed Elon Musk, it doesn't seem to have dimmed his star much with engineer-minded, you know, big problem-solving, idealistic, you know, wanting to fight climate change type students and new graduates. He seems kind of like a rebel rock star figure.
Sorry. Apologies for the chuckle.
No, I mean, it's a little funny.
Yeah. No, it kind of is. So this is it's a company with its headquarters in Palo Alto, right, in California. Mm-hmm. The plant is down in Fremont, sort of in the South Bay there in San Francisco Bay. But it's not your typical fun tech startup, right? I mean, this is an assembly line factory place, not a job where you have beanbags and ping pong tables.
Absolutely. This Silicon Valley dream looks very, very different than being kind of like a cog in the machine at Google or Facebook, where you would come to expect beanbags or, you know, free food at the very least. And there's nothing resembling that at Tesla. It's really a car manufacturer and a battery maker at the end of the day.
Does it look good on the resume, though? Is that part of what's going on here? Not for the Tesla job, but for the next job, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, folks have told me it's really kind of like money in the bank. You work your butt off, give up any semblance of free time or, you know, like work-life balance, but you get to solve these really, really complicated problems that no one is attempting. And I think that's really exciting to folks who want to make a difference in the world.
There's a great anecdote about this woman who found this tweak in the assembly line so tell us that story.
So this is a woman named Anusha who's doing her MBA right now at Carnegie Mellon University. So she's an MBA intern. It's a bunch of like business school students who are on the manufacturing assembly line. And she comes up with this idea for a way to tweak the workflow process. She was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to make a presentation. I'm going to put together a PowerPoint and bring everyone together. And people seemed into it. They were like, yeah, that's smart. We should definitely do that. She's like, great, let's do a follow-up meeting next week and we can touch base with the management and see if they, you know, have a plan for rollout. And she was told by her manager, no, let's just do this right now and implement it tomorrow. And that was super exciting for her. I mean, I think that was really the highlight of her summer. And you can kind of see the way in which that idea is really beautiful, that promise of being able to just step into the job and do your best, you know, fix whatever you think needs fixing. It's probably a little bit different if you're like 45 and you have lots and lots of years putting together automobiles and you're being told what to do by the intern.
Kelsey G, she covers the workplace for the Wall Street Journal. Kelsey, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today, in which I'm obliged to point out, not for the first time, that the President of the United States has some gaps in his understanding of international trade. The President did one of those standing next to a helicopter Q&A things with reporters today. He was asked about the climate report. He said he doesn't believe it. He was asked about the GM layoffs. He said he doesn't like them. And then he was asked about Prime Minister May's Brexit deal. And he said this.
Right now, as the deal stands, they may not be able to trade with the U.S., and I don't think they want that at all. That would be a very big negative for the deal.
To which Prime Minister May's spokeswoman said in a statement at like 9 or 10 o'clock at night, London time, that it is very clear in the agreement with the EU that Britain can indeed sign trade deals, including with the U.S. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 354 today, 1.4%. The NASDAQ up 142, that is 2%. The S&P 540 points to the good, 1.5%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Phoebe Unterman. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.